How about if you gave it as a synonym?
Well, what? Why bought it?
Clarification.
Would it clarify?
Synonyms usually do.
Well, if it's that kind of situation, okay. As I say, I'm not saying that it's never okay to ask what is X. I'm just saying watch out. And in this case, I doubt whether Ryan would be satisfied with a synonym. So you wanted some clarification, some illumination, and just giving a synonym won't do it. But neither will say that it's something else usually clarifies. That's why if you say what questions would be illuminating, it's usually going to be some other kind. But remember, we introduced the notion of intentional action as a way of answering the question, what is behavior? Not literally, but what we said is, here is a place where one would be strongly tempted to ask for and give a definition of behavior. I said, but we can't, but here's something else that's even better, namely a parametric analysis. So you ask, what is reality? What is existence? Any fundamental term, if you ask that sort of thing, the most you can come up with is nonsense, or something in which you really ignore the question and just say something that makes sense. But it's not as though it was a question that you could answer. Now, this whole line of argument is a typical existential move. Namely, everything is what it is, and it's not really something else. Particularly, it's not really something else of a hidden, invisible, mysterious sort. But that's also part of phenomenology, that there are no hidden things. Things are out there to be seen. There's nothing else behind those things that makes them real. Well, I'd go that far. I'd say there's nothing else behind the visible things that makes them real, but I wouldn't go as far as to say there are not things that are invisible. I would say that there's nothing that you can't see. It's just that the reality of what you do see doesn't depend on the reality of what you don't see. See, that's the crucial move, not the other. Observing is something that people do.
Okay, but you would say there's no such thing. But that's not the same thing as saying there's no such thing as experience.
Right.
Between saying there's no such thing as observation and no such thing as experience.
Well, see, formally, since observation is also a category for seeing, hearing, etc., you might argue, well, and why don't you straightforwardly say there's no such thing as observation the way you say there's no such thing as experience? The answer is that there is a form of behavior called observing. And that's what makes observation more than merely a category term. See, I can take 5 minutes to observe the smoke rising from that stack. If you ask me what I'm doing, I say I'm observing the smoke.
Why is it that you wouldn't want to say that?
I will. Well, again, think of the implications. If I'm observing the smoke, I'm doing it on purpose. The implication is I have something in mind. I'm engaged in some kind of practice that calls for doing this. Whereas if I say I'm experiencing the smoke, you wipe out those implications. See, even in ordinary language, saying I experience it is not the same as saying I'm observing it. Because you can experience and observe things incidental to what you're doing, or observing can be what you're doing.
What?
Observing can be what you're doing at a given time. It may also be incidental to what you're doing at a given time. Experiencing, I would say, is going to be incidental. You can't just take 5 minutes to experience something. You're always going to have to be doing something in which you're experiencing something.
There's no actual called experience.
Right.
It sounds like a significance.
Well, it's the pattern kind of thing. It's the action. I am engaging in some kind of social practice by watching that thing.
It's like if somebody said, I'm experiencing, I think another person would say, yeah, but what am I doing?
Right. Whereas if I say, I'm watching that smokestack, they don't say, but what are you doing? They say, why? or they go away muttering some kind of ID description. you know about bird watchers and girl watchers, but smokestack watchers?
Okay, you would say observing is something that people do. What would you say in a similar way about experience or experiencing?
I'm not sure I'd say anything. At best, if I was among friends and didn't have to worry about getting misinterpreted, I'd say experience is something people have. See, if I see the smokestack, I'm aware of the smokestack, I'm conscious of it, I experience it, but also I have the experience of it. All of those follow from the fact that I'm watching that smokestack. See, all of those are different ways of doing this non-committal business. And it's the grammatical form, to a large extent, that makes it seem like there's a something called experience, which is what you start from.
I think sometimes we use the word experience when we want to include many different things like feeling, hearing, seeing of a
See, we don't have terms like experience and conscious and aware for nothing. They're not just synonyms for one another. And one of the distinctive uses of experience is just this sort of thing. In fact, these days, since experience is used so much in so many ways, there's usually the qualifier, the total experience, in which you throw everything that's present in. In contrast, aware is almost always directed, like I'm aware of something or other. But you have a corresponding form. I had the awareness of it. But you almost never say, I had the awareness of everything going on in the room. You said, I had this experience of everything going on. But you could. There's a number of shifts in emphasis. But they too, you see, experience, awareness, consciousness themselves are a set of family terms. Now, what this line of development with respect to experience, as you can see, you could, with variations, use to deal with mental processes and mental concepts of any sort. Is with experiencing, imagining, thinking, problem solving, what else? Remembering,
fantasizing,
dreaming, and the key move is the notion of a paradigm case and a transformation, which is basically a deletion operation. For example, notice how we started with a paradigm case here of somebody seeing a lion and it's really there, or somebody seeing a pink elephant and it's there. Then when from that situation we delete the pink elephant, what are we left with? What we're left with is the experience. What we're left with is the perception. What we're left with is the thought. What we're left with is the delusion. What we're left with is the belief. And if we didn't know what pink elephants were like, we'd have no idea what the experience of a pink elephant was like, or what a person believed if he believed there was a pink elephant, or what kind of delusion it was if he had the delusion that there was a pink elephant. Without the basic paradigm of there really being one like that, all of these others would fall by the wayside. So it isn't merely a paradigm case, it also has logical priority over these others, in that you could have real pink elephants and seeing without ever having merely the experience or merely the belief, etc. But you couldn't have a belief if it were not possible to have a real one. One wouldn't know what belief that was. I said the crucial notion here is that you get mental concepts of various sorts by deletion operations from public observable things. I use the pink elephant as an example. That if there were a pink elephant and you saw him, that would be non-problematical. On the other hand, if something happens and you say, I see a pink elephant, and I look and I don't see one there, something is problematical, and what do I do with that? Well, I accord your description some validity by performing a deletion operation. I say, he sees one even though there isn't one there. And so, in order to distinguish that seeing from the paradigm case where it's there and you see it, I say, he has the perception, he perceives a pink elephant. And to do justice to what goes with that, I say he believes there's a pink elephant there. And then to explain it, I talk about delusions or fantasies or something else. So in those ways, I account for the fact that this is not a paradigm case situation where there is something there and you're seeing it. On the other hand, how else would I describe what's going on? If not to say, well, he sees it even though it's not there. How else could I do justice to what's going on with you?
Delete the perception process.
No, you delete the real thing. You delete the pink elephant and you're left with all of the subjective, psychological, mental terms. But as I say, unless you have the full paradigm, those terms aren't going to make sense. We don't know about a pink elephant, how would you understand my having the thought of a pink elephant? How could you understand my intention to go look for one? There'd be no such thing. So, as I say, crucial is the notion of a deletion operation from a public situation which sets a paradigm. Secondly, is the notion of facts rather than processes or things. You see, you can parcel out facts in various ways. It's a lot harder to divide up things or processes. See, what I just went through is saying, well, look, how do I do justice to the facts that you said, and I don't think you're lying, I see a pink elephant, and yet I don't see one, and those are the facts. How do I formulate those facts in such a way that the whole thing hangs together? Well, talking about your mental processes is the standard way of doing it. But that means that talking about your mental processes is a way that I have as an observer to deal with certain kinds of facts about what you do or don't say or how you do or don't act. It's not that somehow I can get into your head and have your experience. And you can do this sort of thing if you're dealing with facts. If you're dealing with perception as a process, for example, it's going to have to be a very strange process you're going through. And then there's going to have to be a process of my finding out about your process. And that's going to be the process of empathizing or something like that. So you can see how you can multiply entities very rapidly this way.
The fact that our language enables us to describe things that aren't facts,
clause, provide for a lot of these problems that there are.
Well,
what's going on? It mostly occurs in verbal behavior. Are there cases where it doesn't?
I suspect that it's because it's so easy to do verbally that you can easily talk that way. And then once you start talking about that way, think that it's really that way. Just think that there's a corresponding reality. For example, once you start talking about mental processes, it's easy then to invent a mental realm within which these processes occur. Because if a process occurs, it's got to occur within some medium. It has to consist of a change, and the change has to be a change of something to something else. So when a process occurs, there's got to be some kind of substrate. And for people, you know darn well that as soon as you start thinking that way, that substrate is either going to be experiential or physiological. And then you will have invented a new reality, namely the physiological reality or the experiential reality. Why? Because the substrate is what remains through all of these changes. See, if it's your experience that is changing and acquiring new characteristics and losing others, then experience is the thing that doesn't change. If it's your body that's undergoing a lot of neurological happenings, then it's your neurological structures that basically don't change. So substrate has the kind of permanence that processes don't.
What about information processing? Would that be a third type? If you talk about your structures in terms of computer information.
I hate to get into that because information processing is another one of those non-existent things. What you process are signals, not information. And at some point you reinterpret the signal as information. But what you're not processing is information. Unless you're a human being. If you look at the workings of a computer, what you have are signals of various sorts. And the product is a piece of paper with a bunch of marks on it. And then you interpret that as information, but the computer doesn't. See, the computer operates causally in terms of signals, not intellectually in terms of information. Unless you had a computer of a peculiar sort, this is what you would say of it. If you ask yourself, what kind of computer would it take before we'd say it's processing information, the answer is a computer that worked like people. And then, of course, you'd say, and what kind of computer is that? And there you're stuck with it for an answer. So information processing, again, is one of those notions that you have to be careful with at certain critical points. Sure, I'd say it's a second-hand way. What I'd say is that if you didn't have any facts by observation, it's hard to see how you could get any by thinking. You acquire facts in other ways than just by observation. You also acquire them by thought. But somewhere in the prose, I think I commented, the observation is fundamental because you couldn't have the other kind without this kind. But saying you couldn't have the other kind without this kind is not to say that the other kind is a second-hand version of this kind, or that it's a defective version of it, or anything of that sort. Well, as I said, that's a kind of learning that we're familiar with. A different term for it is firsthand learning. Learning by doing. Experiential learning. Think of learning how to ride a bicycle. You can't usually do it just by being told. You have to go practice. That's first-hand learning.
Or practice
with
experience with something. With practice, then you have a repetition session.
Well,
or an issue of something.
See, here's the thing. It was tempting to say you learn skills by practice and you learn concepts by experience. But in fact, it's hard to separate practice and experience because both of them are, you might say, convenient ways of saying the same thing, namely that you're living a certain way, that your history is of a certain kind. And even though one of them is slanted toward behavior and the other is slanted toward cognition, still, you don't really have that kind of separation. And at that point, I simply lumped both practice and experience together, and then correspondingly lumped concepts and skills together. So you acquire either of these via either of these.
When you talked about your Chinese question, your observations of the fundamental thinking, you couldn't have that at the other. You said you didn't like the idea of second order, but...
No, second hand.
I mean, second hand, right. But...
See, thinking is not a second hand way of observing.
Right, but observation would have to come first.
Usually, yeah. You can have an interesting argument as to whether it has to come first or whether it just has to be there at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
But you know darn well that even though it's an interesting argument, in fact, almost certainly it's going to be there first.
That's like the motivation.
It's like saying, well, you only have to have the motivation and knowledge and skills at the same time as the performance, but in fact, you know darn well that it would be a rare case if they were not there first. And that's why it's so easy to think of them as prior causes. Well, I think we've pretty well taken up the whole hour here. For next time, as I say, study the chapter on Levine.
Yeah.
Should have asked that one.
If we don't, I'd rather it came as a glad surprise. No, I have a transcript of a portion of a psychoanalytic interview, but not.
Because I was interested in knowing just how much they would say, because, you know, would they ever, is it just in their write-up that they would talk about things like, well, Gloria's motive being or her world design, or would they ever really directly discuss those kinds of terms with the client?
Well, I think inevitably you get it both ways. See, unlike psychoanalysis, which would take a lot of teaching to get the client to talk that way and then be able to talk to him in those terms, the existential terminology is ordinary language, and because of that, you can introduce a notion like your world design is and just explain it right on the spot and then go ahead and talk that way. So I would bet heavily that you'd get both.
What is meant by that there's either less or no foundation of existentialism versus other theories, but there is a foundation?
No, other theories don't talk about foundations because you have a separate sort of thing called philosophy of science to talk about the foundations of theories. The theories themselves don't raise the issue at all. Existential theory does. It raises the issue of foundations, finds that there are not any, and that's why it talks you into this position of despair.
You said that, what is it about existentialism that gives interesting theory, it gives it, you know, us the ability to talk about theory and other theories within the theory itself.
Because they use a certain set of concepts, and these are what you might call objective or reality concepts, namely concepts like people, concepts like thinking, concepts like acting, choosing, and talking, and saying things. And an individual who can do that is an individual who can use a theory. The theory is a way of thinking, a way of talking. It is something that you choose to use as a person. But see, organisms don't use theories. Organisms metabolize. Organisms function in relation to an environment. So something that has the characteristics merely of an organism is not something of which you could raise questions of what does it think about the truth value of the statement. And so the limitation lies in the concepts of the theory itself. What do they enable you to talk about? And since existential concepts are basically ordinary language concepts, you can talk about people and what they do. Whereas in the theories, you can't.
I'm wondering how the notion of responsibility and the idea of one becomes by creating himself, this notion of self-actualization, jives with the notion of thrownness or ground of existence. I'm still confused about, I think, those notions. And that the idea of a limit, you know, you're placed in this world in a situation which you haven't chosen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me introduce a quasi-technical notion and call it conditions of success. Now think of the standard example. I've lost my glasses and I go into the next room to look for them. Now, there are some traditional ways of talking, for example, that if I go to in the next room to look for my glasses, then I assume that they're there. And only if I assume that they're there, would it make sense for me to go look there. In contrast, one can say, no, you know, what do you mean, assume? You see, you don't have to assume they're there in order for it to make sense for you to go look there. What happens is that if you look there and they're not there, you won't find them. No. Think of that success of finding the glasses, if you look where they are, as comparable to the notion of authenticity. You have the freedom to choose, and you create yourself. But if you make the wrong choices, you're inauthentic. If, in fact, you're not, you don't have it in you to be the kind of person that you created an inauthentic person. And that's different from having a restriction on your choices.
Choose a choice that is authentic. It is authentic because of your thrownness or ground of existence. No, and it's authentic, and then you're not responsible for it.
No. The ground of existence sets limits to what you can do and be authentic. Just as the location of the glasses sets limits to where I can look for them and find them. But the location of the glasses doesn't constrain me in where I look and how I choose to look. So there is a constraint there, yeah, and it's what I, in descriptive, we call it a reality constraint. Namely, you can't just do anything and succeed at anything. If it's going to be certain kinds of success, they have to be done certain ways, or you don't succeed. And that's simply a brute fact. So the freedom of choice does not conflict or contrast with the reality constraint set by thrownness. I think if you keep in mind that paradigm of conditions of success, that kind of ties them together.
I think we've talked about it before a couple of times, but would you say again what a theory is, the descriptive psychology is a theory?
A body of propositions. A theory is a body of statements that say that something is the case. descriptive psychology is not a statement of any kind. It's simply a big, elaborate concept with a lot of internal structure. And from that start, you can say with statements, they can be true or not true. You can believe them or disbelieve them. You can doubt them or not doubt them. You can possibly find evidence for them or find evidence against them. None of these is the case with concepts. You can't believe them, you can't doubt them, there can't be any evidence for them, for or against. They can't be true or false. The closest to a rejection is that you don't use it. That's the thing, that concepts you use, whereas statements you believe or disbelieve, gather evidence for, confirm, etc. Theories, it's always in the plural.
Why?
Because there's no limit to the number of theories one might have on a given subject. And in general, we already have more than one about anything that you can think of.
All right, so then you mentioned theories of psychopathology, you're not referring to the same thing as the concept.
No, that's why psychopathology appears as a phenomenon. And then in a separate place, you have theories of psychopathology, and there's an arrow connecting them, as you might hope. Yeah. See, the lower line is all theories, and then right above it are, in general, the things that these are theories of, or theories about. Because here again, the phenomena doesn't depend on our theorizing about it. So the theorizing is a separate phenomena from the phenomena itself. You might say the phenomena has to be there first in order for there to be something for the theory to be a theory about. And that means that there has to be some non-theoretical descriptive system that identifies the phenomena independently of any theory. No, there has to be one. Otherwise, you don't know that there's a phenomenon. See, for example, think of the definition of psychopathology or pathological state in contrast to theories of pathology. If you didn't have some notion of psychopathology independently of theories, you would have invented psychopathology when you invented your theory.
I'm just trying to make your explicit notion.
Oh. Any other questions? Well, I decided not to get into Levine. And in effect, to stop now with our didactic work and simply remind you that the reading assignment on Levine still holds. That you may have a question on that on the final exam. Also remind you to get all of your exercise assignments in. And I won't ask you to do Fritz and Gloria in terms of Levine, but descriptive, operant, Allport, and existential, and psychoanalytic. The final will be whenever and wherever it's scheduled. Somewhere there is written down where and when the final for this course is. I think it's in the schedule of courses, isn't it?
No, it isn't. It isn't because this is not a regular course. There's a 12:30 teacher and a 12:30.
Well, 12:30. Nobody knows what the times are, huh? This Friday?
This Friday?
Wait a second, let me...
See it coming up there.
She's not there. Look on the bulletin board out here for a notice, and I'll choose the later time if we have the option of the time that goes for 12:30 or the time that goes for 2. I'll choose whichever one comes later, unless you all want to leave early. Yeah, well, look, let's just take a vote. How many would rather have the earlier date? Well, the earlier date may be Friday, I gather.
Or Saturday.
Yeah.
I just can't have an
afternoon. Can you have it just, I said it's fine.
You can't.
Can you do that?
You take home.
It's a possibility, but it's one that I shrink from. Because any take-home exam to be worthwhile would have to be of sufficient length and complexity to make it worthwhile, and I hesitate to think about reading that set of exams. I'd rather drag you in here for an hour, give you a relatively easy one, and be able to read it quickly, and it's all over with, instead of agonizing over a take-home.
What nature is...
Well, let me get into that. First, let's get the issue of how many people would rather have the early date. If somebody says Aristotle, most of you will automatically think of a syllogism. Now, A implies B, A therefore B. It's probably what he's best known for. If you're a psychologist, you may also think of Levine's and Skinner's and other psychologists' attacks on Aristotle and Aristotelian thinking. Now, it happens that there is another feature in Aristotle's writing which is of interest to psychologists, namely a theory of behavior. And Aristotle's theory of behavior he called the practical syllogism. The A implies B, A therefore B, he called a theoretical syllogism. He had a different one which was essentially a theory of behavior, and he called it the practical syllogism. And since he didn't have our technical devices for presenting and explicating this, he did it mainly with a series of examples which we would now call paradigm cases. And the first one is this case. It says, I need a cow. There are cows in the market, so I'll go there and get one. This for him was practical reasoning. And the conclusion of this bit of practical reasoning was not a statement or a belief, but the actual action of going to the market and getting the cow. So what you have in this example compare these two forms here. This one is the classic that you're familiar with. This is an example of the practical facility. Now, a different example is this. I need a covering. A cloak is a covering, so I'll make one. Now, the sense in which for him this was a syllogism is that these things account for this, that they explain the occurrence of this. Just as here, these two things explain the drawing of this conclusion. Now, if you look at what's in these paradigm cases and make the usual move here, see, what do you find? Well, you find that the first line is the W. I need a cow, I need a cover. That's the motivational term. The second line is the factual cognitive term. There are cows in the market, a cloak is a covering. These are state of affairs discriminations. Here is something that's the case, that's a distinction that is being made. Now, here, the bottom line is this. So I'll go there and get one. Be something on this order. We have this one dangling, and somewhere in that total body of writing is an offhand comment. Of course, doing that requires learning. Or, of course, learning is presupposed, something on that order. Think of what that means in terms of a historical perspective on all of this. Here's Aristotle 2,000 years ago. And he's talking in ways that were advanced for that time. Today we have other ways of talking that are more complex and have greater technical resources. But as we look and ask, what did he say in that idiom then? We find something very familiar. Now, what would you make of this? Suppose you take this at face value and say, well, it looks like this concept has been with us essentially as far back as recorded history.
It seems that you're not, just because you can put Aristotle's way of speaking in a descriptive framework, doesn't say anything about whether he was using a descriptive framework. It was, you can put psychoanalytic terms in those notions, or operant terms, you can also put that in those terms. And it's not saying that there's any correspondence between descriptive and that back then. In terms of, wasn't looked at in terms of the descriptive system.
No, that's why I say that he had this way of talking and this way of thinking. But as we look at this way of thinking and compare it with this, see, you say, yeah, he's clearly making these kinds of distinctions in the first two lines. He's clearly talking about these two kinds of things here. And if he makes the comments that I'm pretty sure he made, although I can't quote you chapter and verse, then he has also brought in this kind of notion. And it's not that he was using a descriptive framework, is that he was bringing together in this one notion of the practical syllogism the same kinds of things that are brought together in this version of intentional action and are brought together in the notion of trait and in the notion of instinct, etc. That all of these ways of talking bring together the same kind of parameters.
Did Aristotle, though, have a system besides this way of talking? System for an explanation of behavior other than this? So that this wasn't...
This wasn't an isolated thing. See, this gives him a way of talking about what he called causes. And he had a whole taxonomy of causes. He had formal causes, material causes, efficient causes. See, this is the efficient cause of this. These are the formal causes of this. So it's not a matter that people are using the same conceptual system as formulated. It's that, to all appearances, it's the same set of distinctions, the same package that people have been using as far back as we have a record.
It seems to me that there must be some need for making theories so that you start out with a descriptive, some sort of description of behavior. And historically, there was some need for going beyond that to theorize.
Well, that's part of the moral of the story. Have we gone beyond this in our theorizing? We're making the same distinctions, putting them in the same package. Do we now have explanation where before we only had description? Do we now know something fundamentally different about behavior that we didn't know before? Secondly, of all of the things that we've examined, namely intentional action, instinct, trait, conditioned operant, and motivated behavior, which one does this most resemble? How about that? No. Just think back through the comparative analysis of these behavior notions and what we did in each one, and ask yourself, which does this one resemble most? Well, if it doesn't come through, let me tell you, it's the conditioned operant. Why? Because this unit here, the third line, corresponds to the operant, performance and achievement. The front two lines correspond to the two kinds of controlling variables that we established go with conditioned operants. We we saw that in the conditioned operant, the fact of conditioning was a separate sort of notion from the fact of two kinds of controlling variables. See, these are simply two kinds of controlling variables, whereas this is the fact of the conditioning history. So this one stands in contrast with these two in operant conditioning theory, and it stands in contrast with these two in the practical syllogism. Finally, this one is divided in terms of cause and effect, except this particular kind of cause and effect is not the Humean billiard ball deterministic cause and effect. But he did say cause and effect. And that too is a point of resemblance to the conditioned operant, in which these things are the causes of these as effects. So you might say, not only in the issue of the five parameters is there a general resemblance to all of our modern notions of behavior, there is a point-to-point correspondence between the Aristotelian notion of practical reason and the Skinnerian notion of a conditioned operant. You get the same packages, namely these two going together, these two being variations on the same kind of thing. Over here, they're two different kinds of premise. Over here, they're two different kinds of controlling variables. This comes in as a third thing of a different kind from these two. And these five things are arranged in a cause and effect way with these three things on this side and these two things on that side. So what's the point of difference? The point of difference is that this is a different kind of cause. So I say Aristotle had a taxonomy, and for him this was a formal cause. In Skinner's approach, these are what Aristotle would call material causes and effective causes. For Aristotle, this is a formal cause, in that it's not something that immediately precedes and in that way brings about this. Instead, like this, see, this is what accounts not primarily for the occurrence of this, but it accounts for the fact that this is what it is. That knowing this tells you why this conclusion is the particular conclusion it is and not some other one. And that kind of connection, you can say this accounts for this, or these account for this, but that's not a cause-effect in the way that we think of the cause precedes the effect. So that's the way these related to this in the practical syllogism. In contrast, for Skinner, these are the preceding causes which explain the occurrence of these as later effects.
Possibly two ways of saying the same thing.
Absolutely not. Suppose I point a gun at you and say, here is a bee, and you say, here is a bee. Now, my pointing the gun at you explains the occurrence of your statement that here is a bee. Now, contrast that explanation to this one. Very different kind of phenomenon. If we say, here is what he thought, and here is what he concluded, and his thinking this explains why it was this that he concluded and not something else. P- put it differently, this is rational and so is this, whereas the deterministic cause and effect, the material cause, is not rational. It was on the basis of these kinds of notions that Aristotle defined man as the rational animal. Now, that's also present here if you go to deliberate action rather than merely intentional action. If you have deliberate action, you can see these as reasons for doing this, and acting in terms of those reasons, having mastered, in terms of competence, the four perspectives, it will be a paradigm of rationality. Well, I think it does something to recognize the degree to which 2,000 years ago Aristotle had all of these things figured out and written down and systematized and very neatly cataloged without the aid of modern experimental design or techniques or instruments. And then conversely, how little we've added to that with our modern ways of thinking, our techniques, our experimental design, our statistics, our instruments. And then the next question is, well, is this simply a horrible accident that now that we know about it, we'll be able to change? Well, you might take that tack. I think you'd probably be disappointed, but that's one way you could go from that starting point. Another is to take seriously that people haven't been wrong down through the ages in talking about behavior this way. And then what's the conclusion? That they've been talking about this, about human behavior this way, not merely because, in fact, that's what human behavior is, but rather because being this way is what it takes to be human behavior. And in that case, there's no puzzle about why everybody has been using that same set of distinctions and that same package. Well, it sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? The reason we describe behavior that way is that's what behavior is. Something like that. See, it's more than maxim one, because what it amounts to is that no amount of evidence would show otherwise, because that in effect is a definition of behavior. You wouldn't count it as behavior if it was something very different from that. Notice, indeed, all of the devices that we have using this to explain away surprising observations, or not explain them away, but explain them, that none of those ways requires giving up this notion of behavior. Well, if you decide then that it's not that now that we have empirical methods, maybe tomorrow we'll discover that behavior is really something quite different from this, that raises some issues. Number one, what's research on people and their behavior all about then? You know, where is there a place to do some meaningful research? Secondly, what does that imply for us, for example, as therapists, if we no longer have the excuse that when we know more about behavior, we'll be able to cure people faster? Where does that leave us then? or when we know more about behavior, we'll be able to cure people's social ills. Now that helps you zero in on the fact that this may be definitional, but we don't know all there is to know about behavior. That there are some things which are genuinely matters of fact, and we probably do indeed need to know more of those in order to cure people faster or solve our social ills. But it isn't this. It isn't this that we have to find out about behavior in order to do those things. So one of the things that I'd like you to be thinking about is where is there a place? Which kinds of things about people and behavior are really empirical and you really do have to go and find out in order to know them? And which kinds would we need for what purposes? And I guess we'll be hitting this again next semester in connection with research on Rorschach TATs and other methods of assessment. Okay, so the moral for today is remember Aristotle. Watch for a announcement on the board. Again, it's the same thing as with take-home. If it's open book, it's going to have to be longer and harder. If it's closed, it'll be shorter and easier.
This class has always been open book in the past.
Huh?
It's always open book in the past.
I don't know. I haven't been counting. Well, it isn't. As I say, you have to do more work, and then I have to do more work.
Why do
you
have to do more work?
Because I ask you harder questions if you have a thing to refer to. That's fine. See, if you have an open book, I'm not going to ask you to explain the parameters of intentional action because you've got them written. If you don't have the book, I may ask you to explain three parameters. So the questions you ask on an open book type exam are harder than on a closed book. That means they're going to be longer, etc. So as far as I can see, it's a pretty even trade-off, and it's just a matter of flipping a coin or consulting your intuition or something. I don't know. Is there a strong feeling about, is there a strong preference for one or the other? Because I don't much care. I'm just telling you that you don't get something for nothing.
I just think it's your natural material.
Well, let's have a show of hands. How many would rather have an open book exam? Open book. How many would rather have a closed book? I think the eyes have it. No, that's not one of the options in this social practice. Yeah. Okay, watch the bulletin board for the time and place of the final exam.